Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a Coast Guard veteran and the story of a tool he borrowed from his ship, then returned it 61 years later. He also remembers some haunting encounters with kamikazes at Okinawa.
Japanese fighter plane came through the harbor, and he must have done a barrel roll, and just the sound of the engines made my knees get weak.
Catch all this veteran's unique experiences today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, where each week we visit with World War II veterans, hoping to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and along the way, be certainly entertained, kept awake, educated, and inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We've got quite the story in store today with 89-year-old Jim Kitchen of Fresno, California. He's going to be 90 in October, and hopefully in October he'll be heading to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. You've heard a lot about that. You'll hear some more. But we're going to go back a little further in time, not to the future, but way back in the past. And you grew up, Jim, in Oklahoma. What was that like before the Dust Bowl?
Well, to me, it was, I don't remember suffering any at all, because my brother and I, we just had a slingshot around our neck. We went hunting, and we just enjoyed what we were doing. We don't remember any hard times.
What would you hunt with your slingshot?
We hunted, but we never caught anything. Oh, we'd shoot at the birds, but we'd take our dogs and go down in the woods hunting, and maybe they'd jump a rabbit or something, but we just out having a good time.
And we're going to hear about what you did in World War II and about your more recent history with the ship you served on in the U.S. Coast Guard. But something really life-changing happened when you were just 10 years old. You lost your father at that young age?
Yes, I lost my father, and it was very disturbing because we were on a farm, and my mother couldn't do any farming, and I wasn't old enough to do anything. But anyway, my grandfather, her father brought us out to California, and we stayed 3 months. We were in Antioch, and she was working in the asparagus on the river. And I had a sister that got quick pneumonia, and she died in 3 days. And we went back to Oklahoma and moved into town, and she was working in a plant where they canned meat. And my brother and I would do a laundry or washing before we went to school, and she'd iron it, and we'd deliver it in our wagons. She got remarried, and we came out to California in 36, settled in Orange Cove. And we were Okies, as we are called, and we're not ashamed of it, because we have enjoyed our lives very much.
You know, I could tell the first time I talked to you on the phone, and certainly meeting you here in person, you're someone who has a lot of energy, a lot of exuberance and enthusiasm, and I don't know that you would expect that to result from the kind of tragedy you dealt with as a young boy. What do you think it was that helped you overcome losing your father and your sister when you were just a kid?
Well, I can't tell you just what it is, but I guess I've just enjoyed living and just kept going.
So you come out to California in 1936 and settle in Orange Cove on the east side of the San Joaquin Valley. What was life like in Orange Cove in the late 30s, early 40s?
We enjoyed it because we were going to school, and I graduated there in 39 from the eighth grade, and I only know of one of them that's left yet.
Where'd you go to high school?
I went to Roosevelt, but I didn't finish high school. My mother, in 39, she got TB, and county came and says, you're going to Fresno to the hospital. She had TB, sawed off 6 ribs, collapsed 1 lung, and sent her up to Wichita Sanitarium to die. But my mother did what the doctor said, told her to do. She came home 2 weeks before we went. My brother and I went in the service. We went in together. We were in boot camp together. And she got well. When we came home, she was working. She had got well and working at the community hospital in the kitchen, cooking. The dietitian took a liking to her and made her assistant dietitian. She stayed with her until she was retired, and she died at 86.
Wow, well, I see where you get some of your good genes and that spunk you still have at age 89. Before I ask you about getting into the service, tell me about December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day? How'd you find out what happened out in Hawaii?
Okay, I was over at a lady's house that did laundry, picking up my white shirts. She washed them and pressed them. Of course, I don't know what paid for them then, not very much. And they were listening to the radio, and her daughter's boyfriend was in Pearl Harbor at that time, and they were waiting to hear from him to see whether, but I don't know whether he got killed or not.
And you're 18 years old at the time. What did that do to get that news?
It was disturbing that we were being attacked and we were going to be at war. Yeah, I was getting my notice that I'd be drafted, and I'd already signed up and everything. And so two of our friends that we ran around with joined the Coast Guard. I saw them and I said, well, they joined. Why didn't you tell us? So, you know, and so my brother and I, we both went down and joined.
And when you and your brother, is that younger brother?
Yeah, he's 13 months younger than me.
When you two signed up together, were you thinking they were going to let you stay together?
Oh, we didn't even think about it, but we did in boot camp. He was on top bunk and I was on the bottom bunk. We went through boot camp. After boot camp, went down on the wharf to shipping and receiving. From there, I went to the Golden Gate Lifeboat Station. That's right down on the beach by Playland. It was rough duty, you know, we have to watch the girls go swimming. well, anyway, we'd take the lifeboat out through the waves in case the ship went aground, and I was there for 3 months, and then they shipped me out to the Farallon Islands.
I bet there's some people out there that don't know where the Farallon Islands are. I do. I've never been there. I'd like to go there. Tell us where they are and what it was you were doing out there.
Farallon Islands is 22 miles. It's west of Golden Gate. What we were doing, I had lighthouse duty and foghorn, and another fellow and I were in charge of that. If it got foggy, we started a big diesel up that had a big compressor, and that foghorn would rattle our beds at night. It just so loud. We would get the generators going and at night and turn on the light. Then we would stand a watch to take care of anything.
Well, and I'm intrigued by that duty because I've heard so many veterans tell me about, you know, in the immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor, that there was this widespread concern on the West Coast that the Japanese are coming to the West Coast. If you're out on the Farallons, you're a lot closer to that potential enemy threat than anybody on the mainland. Was that something that you actually thought might happen or not something you expected?
Well, yes, we thought about that a lot because where we stood our watch was down where the generators were going, and that the water was just a little ways down there. And all we had out there was an old rifle, and I don't remember any shells being around for it. And the officer in charge had a .45 and a .38, and a couple of times we got to practice firing those, but we didn't carry it in. And when we'd stand watch at night in the generator room, we would open the little door that we walked in, and the back door closed. And if they come in the back door, open that shut the front door, and we knew to run. But nothing ever happened.
Good thing, because it sounds like if something did, you guys wouldn't have had much firepower at your disposal.
No, I thought about that, not having anything out there. And there was a report, and we had a radio shack out there, too, and a lookout, which was up on one of the peaks there. We had heard of submarines in the area, but never seen any.
You know, as someone who grew up in Oklahoma, I imagine the scenery from the Farallons was a little different than it was out in Oklahoma or even in Orange Cove. Did you have time to enjoy the grandeur of the ocean and your surroundings there?
Yes, we did. My friend and I were in charge of that. Well, as soon as we get the motor cleaned up and everything, and the skies were clear, we got fishing lines, which the government supplied us. And we get some bait, we go over to the island, catch fish, and the cook would cook us up some fish. We would get a $23 a month subsistence for our food. And 1 month, we took enough of fish in, and we had $3 left over that they gave us. And when the tide would get low, he and I would take a sack and go down and fill it up with abalone. And right close to the landing where we would come into the island and get ashore, there was a hole, big hole in a rock there that the waves kept full. And we had a bar 10 foot long and a rake 10 foot long. And we'd go down and day or night get an abalone and two or three, whatever we wanted. And the cook said one, I remember one time, he says, it was 10 o'clock. You guys go get the abalone and we'll eat one. So we went, we prepared them, and he cooked them in butter, and we had crackers and abalone that night.
I got to tell you, I've interviewed hundreds of World War II veterans. I've never had one tell me about catching abalone and having it for dinner, so that's a first. And to be honest, I haven't had too many Coast Guard veterans on the program, and a lot of people think about the Army and the Navy and the Marines, and they think about the Air Force or what was then the Army Air Corps, and they forget about the Coast Guard. At the time, did you Coast Guard guys feel a little overlooked?
No, I didn't have any feeling. We were just called freshwater sailors, hooligan Navy and everything, but I didn't pay any attention to it. But I was out there. It was really good duty. We'd stay a month, 4 weeks, get a week off, we'd come home. And then you stay 6 weeks, you had 2 weeks off. But I did that one time, and it was boring. I says, nobody home to do anything with. But then after I was out there for 9 months, my brother, I knew he was going to go to sea. He went on a freighter, AK-96, and I forget the name of it, pulling a barge. So I went to the officer in charge, and I said, I want to transfer. I want to go to sea. So first thing that hit the dock was my papers that week, and I went into Bayonne, Powell, and stayed 3 weeks or so, and they sent me down to the Coast Guard cutter Taney.
And the Taney is a ship that you can still go experience today. In fact, if you go to the Taney in Baltimore, you can see some of Mr. Kitchen's handiwork on that ship. We're going to get to that eventually. But what was your welcome to the Taney back then in the 1940s?
I'd like to tell you a little more about the Farallons, because it was really interesting. Yeah. That I have pictures there to show you that some of the fellows out there, their wives were living with them. They had houses out there because the lighthouse keepers were doing that duty before the war. And I don't know, must have been a half a dozen women out there on the island with us. It was just fun to be out there, and we'd take the 17-foot dory and go out and row out and go fishing, and it was good duty.
Kind of like your own little world.
Yes, it was. We were out there alone. the buoy tender would bring our supplies out once a week, and that was on a Friday, and they'd bring it into the landing there, let a boom out and a platform down, and they'd put everything on it, and that's how we got ashore.
So you go from that isolated existence to being packed on a Coast Guard ship with a bunch of other young guys and restless guys. Was that an adjustment for you?
Well, yes, I guess it was adjustment. It wasn't hard to adjust to it, because my first trip down when we left San Francisco and got out, and we must have been down around Mexico someplace, but the water was so smooth. It's just like being on a cruise ship. And we get to Panama, and we all got to take liberty and go ashore and look around, and it was very interesting to go through the canal.
Yeah, I bet. I bet that's something that you had read about and certainly heard about, and to be there must have been fun.
It was, and to see how the operation, they had what they call donkeys, and there were tow cars on each side with cables, and they would pull all the ships through. And after you get through the canal, you go into a freshwater lake, and then you go into the Atlantic, and you go through the gates again.
And at that point, did you learn a little bit of the history of the ship that you were on, and where it had been the last couple of years before you got on it?
I've learned a lot about it, and I have pictures of the ship when it went to Baker Island. This was after the war started. They were going to survey it to put a runway on that island, that there was no life on it. But when they got there, there was a plane flying around. It was a plane looking for somebody. And so it flew over and dropped a couple of bombs at them, but they missed. So they went back to Honolulu. And later then they went back But they had escorts, had fighter planes watching them. And they surveyed the island to put the metal runways down. And the fellow that helped me with the memorial was an engineer. After he got out of the service, he was good on the computer. And he had gone to school and learned a little bit about surveying. And the Navy went out to take care of it with the on the ship. And he did the surveying. And the runway is still there, the old metal, but it's not used anymore.
Well, let's talk about the Taney and your job on that ship. Looking at your papers, I see you listed as carpenter's mate, third class. Was that your assignment when you got on the Taney? What was it like when you first got on that ship?
When I first went aboard, I was seaman second. And then I was seaman first. And after some time, then I wanted to go in the carpenter shop because that's what I was doing before I went into service. And so then I finally made carpenter's mate, third class. And as you can see on the picture there, that there was a big plane that I borrowed from the ship when I left it. And we actually used that one time because when we went up to Japan after the war.
I want to make sure our listeners understand here, when you say plane, you're not talking about airplane. You're a carpenter, so you're talking about a plane that a carpenter uses.
I will change that. A smoothing plane that you use to hang doors with. After I got it home, I was a carpenter, and I hung a lot of doors with that plane.
Well, let's not get the end of that story yet. Let's leave our listeners in suspense. But this is a tool that you actually used on the ship. So what kind of duties did you have working with wood on that ship?
One thing that I remember we used it on quite a bit when we went up to, after the war, went up to Japan, Wakayama, to evacuate prisoners. So the skipper wanted to make a mast for one of the lifeboats so he might be able to sail it. We don't understand why he did, but anyway, we went ashore. And we found a nice pole up there, and we brought it back aboard the ship. And believe it or not, we had a foot adze on there. Don't know what that was ever put on there for, but anyway, we used that to size it up pretty good. And we used this big smoothing plane, which is 23 inches long, to finish smoothing it up. And after the war was over and we headed back to Charleston, South Carolina, and I was going to get discharged, well, we stopped in San Francisco first. And I took two big sea bags off, and that plane was in it. And the gunnery officer said, "Kitch, I'm on duty tonight. You guys get your stuff off." After I brought the second bag out, he says, "Kitch, don't take it all off. I got to stay aboard the ship." Anyway, brought it home. We were having a reunion up in Oregon, and one of my shipmates says, "Kitch, if you'll put that back aboard the ship, I won't tell them you stole it." I says, "Look, I've used that. It fits my hand. I can feel it right now." And I thought about that after I got home for a couple, 3 years. And I thought, you know, maybe that'd be the thing to do. So I made a plaque out of it and took it and presented it to him. But it says, "Borrowed tool returned after 61 years.
Yeah, I'll post a picture of this on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, the newspaper article about 61 years later, that smoothing plane being returned. And I guess you can go see that plane if you visit the ship in Baltimore, huh?
You sure can. It's on the bulkhead, and my picture is there with it, smoking my pipe. And the carpenter's mate that was in charge, first class, I went down when I took to the ship. We drove back. Went down to New Mexico and had my picture taken with him, holding a plane, took it up and presented it to him. And it's on there now, and a lot of people go by and see it.
Well, I hope I have that chance someday. We have the chance to hear Jim's story today because a kamikaze that could have claimed his life was thwarted by an able and perhaps fortunate gun crew. We're going to hear about Jim's role in that fateful moment off of Okinawa when Hometown Heroes continues right after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CVHonorFlight.com. Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Jim Kitchen of Fresno, California, originally from Hichita, Oklahoma. He served on the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Taney during World War II. That ship is now a museum in Baltimore, Maryland. And if you visit it, you can find a tool, a smoothing plane he borrowed for 61 years before he returned it. We touched on that story, and we might hear some more later. But let's talk about what you did on that ship during the war. What was the role of that ship, and what are some of the experiences that still stand out in your mind? Because it wasn't just all a picnic for you. I know you enjoyed your time in the Coast Guard, but there were some times that certainly got your attention and raised an eyebrow or two. What can you tell us about that?
I enjoyed what I was doing, and I didn't realize the danger I was in. But we went to the East Coast, went up to Portland, Maine, and damage control inspection. They just got through working on it, but that was the skipper's home, so I guess we just went made a little trip up there. Because he was on liberty and didn't come back that night. Until the next morning. Well, anyway, we went back down to New York for 2 weeks and went to Norfolk, Virginia, and picked up a convoy. And I'm not sure how many ships it was, but I've been told 140, but it was a pretty large convoy. I think there was 15 escorts, and we had a Navy officer, I don't remember his rank, but we were the flagship of the convoy. And we went to North Africa. And we went through the Mediterranean after Gibraltar went by Algiers. It was named Coffin's Corner because that's where the Germans hit a lot of the convoys going into North Africa. And the torpedo planes hit us that night. There's one ship that had bombs, detonators, and 550 soldiers on it. And it was torpedoed, and it went up like an atomic bomb. There was three of our escorts, I think, that went down that night, and a couple others were damaged and had to get towed in. And we had two torpedoes shot at us and missed. So we went on with the convoy and to Bizerte, Tunisia.
And let me interrupt, because I'm wondering, as you're describing this, some of the destruction that's happening around you and the fact that your ship was targeted as well. Where are you while this is going on, and did you have any idea what kind of danger you were in?
Well, that was my first trip out, and I was down in the magazine room on gun one. When that ship exploded, and all the openings coming down there were small because the powder and the 5-inch projectiles went up to the gun. The concussion when that ship blew up, it was about a mile away, they told me. You could feel it coming down. But I didn't know any torpedoes had been shot at us, so we were just sitting down there waiting.
But you could feel things were shaking a little bit.
We felt it when that ship blew up, yes.
And when you found out later the significance of the damage, did that get your attention?
Well, no, it really. I mean, it happened, and I felt bad about the ship blowing up and all those people that went with it. It's disturbing, but I guess we were young and just didn't pay any attention to it. The deal is this. We didn't take the ships all the way in. We went to Bizerte, Tunisia, and we stayed there 30 days while they took them all in and unloaded. And when they brought the ships by, we escorted them back to the States. And we'd go in, like, to Boston. We had 2 weeks' liberty there. But while we were in Bizerte, we were there 30 days, we would go down to where everybody went swimming that come in there and enjoy our time there. And some of the fellows were selling their clothes because, I don't know, they were Arab boys, and they had pockets full of money. And some of the fellows were selling their T-shirts for $20 a T-shirt, their shorts, everything, and have to get clothes when they got back to the States. And so that was the first trip, so I never did sell any, but I got an idea that I wanted to make a little extra too, so I went to the Five and Dime store and bought all the lipstick they had. 10 cents a stick, And the lady says, oh, I know you sailors, anything for a good time. Well, we went back another trip to North Africa, and I proceeded in trying to sell my lipstick. But the Marines were there, and they were searching everybody as they went through. And I had these tied up in a sack in my swimming trunks, and he looked at me, and he says, go on by. I says, oh, boy, when I sell this, this is it. I quit. And so I went down to the beach, sold all my lipstick for $3 a stick.
The lipstick salesman of North Africa. We can just end the show right there. That's a great note. And those are some of the lighthearted memories you have from the war. I know there were some moments, too, that weren't so much fun, that weren't all laughs and giggles. When you think back on the moments where you felt in danger, what are the ones that really stand out for you?
When we were in Okinawa.
What were you guys doing there?
We had an admiral aboard, and I was talking to one of my other shipmates, and he said he was on the bridge all the time, and he said we were third in charge. After three trips to the North Africa with the convoys, they put our ship back in the shipyard in Boston and converted us and took the four guns 5-inch off that they just put on a year earlier and made us into a communication ship. And that took 6 months. And we were to hit Iwo Jima. And we had the Marines aboard ready to go, but it was too late because it already started. And so we let the Marines off and went to through the canal again and stopped in San Diego and then Honolulu. And then, but before we got to Okinawa, though, well, we stopped in Ulithi's and had a beer party. The skipper looked after us. Anyway, in Okinawa, I guess it's just one time, it was nighttime. We'd been at general quarters several times, but we had left Okinawa and go to these, there was a few miles over, it was a lot of little islands there, kind of protected, to get supplies, and a Japanese fighter plane came through the harbor, and he must have done a barrel roll, and just the sound of the engines made my knees get weak.
Where were you on the ship when this was happening?
Oh, I was sitting back on the aft deck just looking around.
So you saw this Japanese plane and...
No, it was dark and you couldn't see it. It just made the noise. This is at nighttime.
So you heard it and that got your attention a little bit.
Just the roar of the engines when they like you do a barrel roll, and it just, I don't know what it did, but never fired a shot or dropped a bomb.
But that wasn't the only time there was a plane headed toward your ship. Okinawa is infamous for the amount of kamikazes in and around that battle. And your ship became a target for one of them?
Yes, we had a plane come in. It was raining, and he came in, and he's coming down our starboard side. And we started shooting at him all the way around, and he got to the port side, broadside to us. And I was the trainer on the gun. I run the gun fore and aft, you know.
Yeah, explain to us how that works. Most people listening have never been on a ship with a gun like this. It takes more than one person to make this gun work and actually have it do what it's supposed to do.
There is a trainer and a pointer, and the trainer runs the gun around, and the pointer up and down, and he pulls the trigger. And then we have ammunition handlers, and then we have projectile and a hot shellman. He catches the brass container when it comes out and throws it away.
And how big are these projectiles?
It's called a 5-inch 38. The projectiles are 5 inches, and they're about 16 inches long, and I'd say the powder can was about 30 inches, so it did make quite a noise.
Yeah, quite a noise, pretty heavy to handle, and obviously can do a fair amount of damage. So you said you're the trainer on this gun, so it's your job to aim this gun side to side.
That is correct, and there's pointers. It's coming from radar that we have to follow. It's kind of fun to do it. If the ship is rolling, you learn just to roll with the waves and keep it there.
Yeah, easier said than done. So, but I imagine it gets pretty tense. I mean, firing that gun in practice is one thing, but when there's a plane heading your way that could crash into your ship and do a whole lot of damage, then this isn't fun and games anymore. Do you remember how that all happened, what it felt like, and how it unfolded?
Well, you know, we were just young kids. They were so many of them that were picking out the larger ships. I saw 9 ships get kamikazes in one day. We were hoping that they'd get close enough that we could shoot at them. But then if we did, we had to help the gunner's mates clean the gun up, the barrel, wash it out, oil it.
And can you maybe help us understand how difficult this is with the plane moving that fast at the altitude where it is? with, you know, having to have this teamwork on the gun, how difficult it was to actually shoot one of these guys down?
Well, it was just luck, because radar tells you how fast they're going and the altitude they're going. And for a plane to be coming down about, say, 300 miles an hour, and you're going to put a projectile in that gun and set the fuse setting that it will go off whatever you set it for, like 2 seconds, 2,000 feet. And with a plane coming down, and then the time that you get all that information and put it in, and it explodes right in front of him, and he rolls over and crashes into the water. It's just, how do you do it?
And you kind of stated that like it's a hypothetical, but that's what actually happened. That's what you guys were able to do to take out that kamikaze.
That is correct. Okay, I'll tell you what I said then. When I stopped moving the gun and I just sitting still, I knew something was wrong. I looked up and I saw the plane coming down on us, and the pointer was Tex. And I said, Tex, if you ain't had the pointers matched, get them matched, because he's coming in. And the gunnery officer must have heard me. It was an open mount gun, and he was kind of standing behind me. So he went around and put that 2 second fuse setting on it. And when that one went off, it exploded right in front of the plane, and it crashed in the water 1,000 feet behind us.
What do you think would have happened if that fuse hadn't been set like that? If it hadn't, if the points hadn't been matched up, if it didn't explode right when and where it did?
Well, if it hadn't, it looked like he was looking down our gun barrel, and I wouldn't be here today. But I don't know, the ammunition handlers, they got scared and run forward, but I sat there and I don't know, I didn't. But when I saw the explosion in front of him, I sure felt good though.
I don't want to exaggerate here, but it sure sounds like you're saying for you guys to put that shell right there and have it explode right there was a bit of a needle in the haystack. And if you hadn't found that needle in a haystack, then y'all would have been dead.
That is correct. I feel that way. We wouldn't be here right now talking.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic or get you to say anything that you don't really feel. But when you think about that moment, because that's significant to me, and I've interviewed so many veterans who have moments like that, how do you account for that? The fact that it happened just that way and you're still here talking to me right now?
Well, you know, I've never thought about it after I went home, and I haven't talked about it much until here just the later years that we've had so many reunions with my shipmates, got together and got to talking and realized what really happened.
So you guys shot down a kamikaze, but that wasn't the only thing that was shot down by your ship. And sometimes it was hard to know who was coming at you. You guys actually shot down an American plane, is that right?
Yes. It came over the island the same way as the first kamikaze that we shot down, and they wouldn't identify themselves. So after they got in over the ships that were anchored in there, we shot him down. After we shot that one down, then a two-motor Betty bomber was coming in just over the water, real close, and it got within 1,000 feet of us before the forward guns knocked it down, and it cleaned the deck of a freighter 1,000 feet in front of us. We had a pretty good gun crew, because when we making those trips to North Africa, they sent us up on the east coast there a little ways, and we would have gunnery practice, and the planes would fly a sleeve by, and we'd shoot at it. And they got unhappy with us, because every time they come by, we shot it down, they had to go back and get another one.
Let's get back to that American plane you shot down. Were you guys able to determine whether that was actually an American crew on that plane, or that maybe it was Japanese soldiers who had stolen an American plane?
Well, the only thing that they could find out, that there was no planes missing on any airstrips or aircraft carriers, and so they just were very sure then it was a stolen plane that they captured on one of the islands, and they came over and they couldn't identify themselves.
Well, and those must have been some tense moments, because they had a chance to identify themselves, and I'm sure everybody on ship is hoping they will, because you don't want to be firing at a plane with American markings.
I was watching as it came over the land, and it got to the ships, and it got past a few of them, and still wouldn't identify themselves, and so that's when the ship took action, the forward guns, and before it got very far.
Airplanes, bombers, fighters, whatever, kamikazes, they weren't the only enemies you guys had, or the only things you had to contend with. The weather was pretty fierce at times, too. How many typhoons did you make it through?
We had 2 typhoons. The ship was designed to go 45 degrees, And we were out there, and I had my life jacket on. I just sat up in front of the smokestack and held on and watching the water. And when it was rolling, and you'd look down at the water, and it would be close. And like I said before, it got real rough, because when you go to the top of the waves, I call them mountains, the props would come out of the water and make a noise, and then it'd go down, and the bow would take on a load of water then. Couple of the ships stayed in anchor, but they got blew up on the beach.
Now, where were you while that typhoon's going on? Were you holding on to something, strapping yourself down? What was that like?
When we went to our bunks at night, they were metal pipe. We had a little mattress 2 inches thick, and then the bunk, it had a rail about 6 inches above the main part of the body of it. We would stick our arms through there so we wouldn't go up and hit the bunk in front of us.
And what's going through your mind in a situation like that? I mean, you're literally hanging on for dear life, I suppose, but what are you thinking?
Well, I don't know. We were just holding on and saying, hey, this is quite a ride.
Yikes. Well, you're taking us on an entertaining ride back in time today, but it's break time again. You know, if you've ever eaten at Denny's on Blackstone and Divisadero in Fresno, or maybe you've played basketball at Fresno's Holmes Playground or Romaine Playground, you've benefited from some of Jim's work. We're going to hear about some of the other things he built after his Coast Guard days when Hometown Heroes continues next after this. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Perhaps you recognize that tune, Semper Paratus, the song of the U.S. Coast Guard. That Latin translates, of course, to always ready. Our guest today, Jim Kitchen, served in the Coast Guard during World War II. You can find a bunch of photos connected to what Jim's sharing with us today. If you go to Facebook, just pull up Hometown Heroes Radio. That's my friends from the Sounds of Freedom Band performing Semper Paratus there. But there was another song you and your shipmates got a kick out of during the war. What's the story there, Jim?
We had a landing barge assigned to us with smoke-making devices on it. And when the planes would get close, then we'd start making smoke and hide the ship so it couldn't be seen. And Red Foley put out a song, and it was his top hit, and I don't know whether it was in 43 or 44 now, but anyway, Smoke on the Water, and it's pretty neat, and it's talking about the victory over Japan.
There will be a sad day coming for the foes of all mankind. They must answer to the people, and it's trouble in their mind. Everybody who must fear them will rejoice on that great day, when the powers of dictators shall be taken all away. There'll be smoke on the water, on the land and the sea, when our army and navy overtakes the enemy. There'll be smoke on the mountains where the heathen gods stay, and the sun that is rising will go down on that day.
Smoke on the Water, Red Foley, from way back in 1944. And I'm sure you're not the only one for whom that brings back a memory or two, Jim. But let's get back to your story.
You talked about where your battle station would be when General Quarters sounded and being part of that gun shooting down the kamikaze. But what about the rest of the time when you weren't at a battle station and you have that title of carpenter's mate? Did you have some woodworking to do on that ship? Did you have repairs to take care of? How often did you live up to that title?
We didn't have much woodwork to work with. But when we were in port, we did make a few plywood boxes for the skipper to ship some of his stuff home. So there's where it was. But our job was, when we pulled into port, we would hook up the water. We would go down below and check the water to see how much we had, cause, and let them know how much. And then the hatches, well, they had screws on them, and you'd twist it to lock the doors. Oh, I've been off too long. The hatches. And we would take a wire brush and clean them and keep them greased up. We'd weigh all the fire extinguishers and make sure they were all charged up. And, well, something went wrong with something. Well, then we were called to go fix it.
I have a feeling you've gotten a few calls to fix it over the years, and you've done a pretty good job of fixing things up and building a lot of things that we'll talk about. But the end of the war, do you remember that moment when you found out, you know what, victory is ours, this thing's over, and I'm going to get to go back home and have a life one of these days?
When the war was over, we had a warning that there could be an all-out attack. Well, I was movie operator on Okinawa, and mornings we didn't normally have any raids. They had a landing barge that would take me ashore to get the film. I was movie operator, and I'd show it at night to the crew.
You remember any of the movies you saw?
Yes, there was one that the boys really enjoyed, and they hooped and hollered, and I think it was Ida Lupino, and she was riding a horse. Now you know what I'm getting at. She was pretty well built, and they really got a kick out of that, and that's about the only one I can tell you about.
That's the one you got the most response to, it sounds like, from your crewmates.
Yeah, and to get the movies, we'd have a comedy. Well, I'd have to take someone with me. So whoever wanted to go, they have a friend or a relative, well, they'd make contact with them and say, I'd like to go over with you a certain day. And this one trip we went over, his friend had a Jeep waiting for us and a couple of beers and took us for a drive around the island where they had already secured, and it was worked up like a dozer had gone over it. And so we got the movie and came on back, and I guess he must have told the gunnery officer was in charge of the movies and called me over and said, now look, Kitch, he says, I don't mind you going ashore and looking around, but tell me where you're going so I can look for you.
And you mentioned after the war had ended, you go to Japan to evacuate prisoners. I imagine that had to be an eye-opening experience.
Well, we didn't see any of the prisoners, but we were there, and we were a communication ship, so, you know, we had radio, but that's what we were there for, is to evacuate. We were there for 31 days, and I got to go ashore there, took the lifeboat, and just went over to the beach where the people were living and took cigarettes and traded for their whatever they had to trade. I brought a couple of things back.
What was it like for you to come back, to be back in the States again? Were there ever times where you weren't sure that was going to happen?
No, I never gave it a thought that I wasn't coming back. But they didn't ask me to sign over and stay any longer. They knew I wanted to come home.
So what was that like to, with the war over, to try to get back to normal life? Because I would imagine coming back to the San Joaquin Valley and trying to find a way for yourself was a little different than being crowded on a 300-foot ship with a bunch of other guys.
No, I just looked forward to coming home and getting started and doing, and I just went to work as a carpenter when I got home.
You know, my dad did a fair amount of carpentry and a lot of welding and built a lot of things, and since my dad's no longer with us, some of those things that he built are good reminders to our family of what he was capable of and what kinds of things were produced by his hands. And I imagine you get that feeling quite a bit. There's a lot of your handiwork around the state of California. Give us a sense of some of the things that you've worked on that are still out there for us to go look at.
Well, I was working for R.G. Fisher. I built 6 Purity Stores tilt-ups. Started in Hanford, Madera, Grass Valley, Auburn, Chico, San Jose. We would build them in 90 days. We would have a meeting with all of the subcontractors and how long it would take them, and we built them in 90 days. And after that meeting was over with, the grocers and everything were ordered to stock that store.
So a lot of people shopped in places that you made sure were put together the right way. And, you know, it's funny, I mentioned to you before we started recording that I was from Las Banas, and you said, hold that thought, came back with a picture. Now, you've got a picture here of you standing next to the frame of the gym I played high school basketball in. You built that Las Banas High School gymnasium?
Yeah, I was working for Harris Construction then, and those beams that you saw, they were an oval, and that was quite a little operation to set those up, pre-drilled all the holes in it, and it was fun to build it.
Well, and it's still there. It's got a big sign that says Tiger Pavilion outside of it. So so thank you for giving me a place to shoot some hoops in and announce some games in too. So you've basically done this your whole life, and I want to get back to that smoothing plane. Did it ever occur to you over all these decades that you shouldn't have that, or that it didn't really belong to you? Was it ever even a thought in your mind?
No, it was never a thought in my mind, because when they brought it back into the States after the war to Charleston, South Carolina, it was going to be made into a rescue ship. You know, everything would be taken off of it.
So if you didn't take it, it still wouldn't have stayed on the ship?
It would have been gone. Somebody would have taken it.
So how did that work out that you got talked into taking it back to that museum ship now sitting in Baltimore, the same ship you served on nearly 70 years ago?
We've had a lot of reunions. We were having one in Portland, Oregon, and I told my wife, I says, let's just take the trailer and take a cruise coming home down the coast. And we stayed at this fellow's house, shipmate, and we were just talking and everything, and he says, well, Kitch, if you take that plane back and put it on the ship, I won't tell them you stole it. And I said, no. As time went by, I thought to myself, there's not much on the ship that was originally there, and it'd be nice to have it. So I made a nice, beautiful plaque and put it back on the ship.
And that's not the only thing you made that is on that ship. You can see it. You can visit it if you go to Baltimore, Maryland. And in fact, a lot of these honor flight crews of World War II veterans fly into Baltimore. A lot of them have the chance to visit. And if they do, they'll look up on the wall. They'll see what looks like a pretty well put together display. And it lists every single person who served aboard your ship during World War II. How did that display come about?
I went over to the Veterans Hospital. They were presenting a memorial over there for all of the services. And I thought, well, that's a memorial. We're not all dead, so why not make a memorial and put it on the ship? Because I had about 350 names that I could put on it. And I talked to the curator on the ship. He says, I'll help you, Jim. He went to Washington, D.C. three times to the artifacts and got a box the first quarter of each month from the time the war started until it ended, 858 names. And he shipped it to me, and a fellow by the name of Dick Phillips, who was an engineer in civilian life, and he was good on the computer, so I sent them to him, and he put it in an alphabetical order and had it printed, and it has a silhouette of the ship and then all the names over it. And the whole thing is about 52 inches across and 42 inches high, and it's beautiful.
But you didn't have to use that smoothing plane on that at all.
No, I have to admit I didn't use that on it at all. In fact, I didn't even make the frame that it's in. I heard that done.
But it wouldn't be there on the Taney without your initiative. So as you've been back to that ship and seen it on display there and seen other veterans and their families look up there and find names, what kind of satisfaction have you gotten out of your contribution?
I feel very good about it, because I have had calls. I had a call here not too long ago from a young man, said my grandfather was on there, and I'd like to learn more about it, and his name was Larson, and I looked on the memorial, and his name was there, and I talked to him, and he is coming to get with us December the 7th when we go back to Baltimore this year.
So you're going to be there again December 7th. Why is it important to keep going back?
I see my shipmates there, just like the one I drove to Bakersfield Monday to have lunch with. And a round trip is 295 miles. But it's just nice to sit there and talk to them and visit. Our reunions have been great. We've had reunions, Hawaii, Texas, Fresno. I had 23 of them at my house at one time. And the women all got to knowing each other, just like a big family when we get together.
You don't look old, but I know you're not getting any younger.
I'll give you a quarter for that.
I guess what I'm getting at is it's been a long time since you were in the Coast Guard. And I want to thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us your story. But when you think back about it all, is there one thing that you're most thankful for, or maybe even most proud of, when you think about that time in your life?
Well, one thing I'm proud of is that I came back home. Yes, and I'm proud of what I did, because I think we served our country well with doing what we did.
Do you think people today have a decent idea of what went on back then? Or do you think, is there something else that you want to add to our understanding of World War II and why what happened was so important still today?
Well, that's a big question, and I don't know as I can tell you about it other than I have enjoyed what I've done and that I'm here.
And I know you've submitted your application for Central Valley Honor Flight. What would that mean to you to visit the World War II Memorial with other World War II veterans?
I am really looking forward to it. I've heard about it, and I've thought about when I go back to Baltimore is to get on the bus and go there and see it. But now that I've got the opportunity to go, I'm going to take it.
So you told us about where you were on December 7th, 41, but the ship you'd eventually serve on was a Pearl Harbor survivor. What do you understand about its activities on December 7th?
The ship wasn't in Pearl Harbor. As you come into Pearl Harbor, to the opening, you go to the left, you go to Pearl Harbor. Go to the right, and it's Honolulu Harbor. But the planes were flying over, and the Taney shot at them and felt they shot one down because it was trailing smoke after they shot at it. And they feel that they protected the electrical plant in Honolulu. And after they didn't get bombed, they were looking for the big ships. And after Pearl Harbor Day, they went out and was sounding for submarines, and they felt that they might have got a mini submarine.
These are stories you heard aboard the ship from guys that had been on the ship at that point?
Yes, and those are stories, and the ship had a pilot. It was a small seaplane. He didn't get back to the ship, but anyway, they gave him duty on land at the airport, their airstrip. The admiral says, and you won't believe this, but they got a Coast Guard in charge of a Navy airstrip. When we went back in 11, it was the 70th anniversary for Pearl Harbor Day. The ship, we received a plaque. As you see me up there holding it, it's from Historic Ships of England. And Lord Greenway came over special to present that plaque to the ship on December the 7th in 11. And I was there, and the carrier of the ship asked me to make a little speech. You know, I didn't have any problem volunteering. And so, as you can see the picture there, I presented another tool back to the ship, and I introduced all the five shipmates that came and what they did a little bit. The admiral, the commandant of the Coast Guard, was next after me, and he was making a very good speaker. After he said a few words, and he said, "Mr. Kitchen." And I thought, boy, I'm in trouble now, all I told about what went on. But I was forgiven for everything I did that told that night, or what I would do in the future, that I still get to keep my good conduct.
It sounds like you have a lot to be thankful for.
I've got a lot to be thankful for. I have lived a good life, and I'll be 90 October the 11th, and I'm still going.
And don't you stop. That's Jim Kitchen of Fresno, California, Coast Guard veteran of World War II. We're out of time on the program today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
There will be a sad day coming for the foes of all mankind. They must answer to the people, and it's trouble in their mind. Everybody who must fear them will rejoice on that great day, when the powers of dictators shall be taken all away. There'll be smoke on the water, on the land and the sea, when our army and navy overtakes the enemy. There'll be smoke on the mountains where the heathen gods stay, and the sun that is rising will go down on that day. For there is a great destroyer made of fire and flesh and steel, rolling toward the foes of freedom. They'll go down beneath its wheels. There'll be nothing left but vultures to inhabit all that land, when our modern ships and bombers make a graveyard of Japan. There'll be smoke on the water, on the land and the sea, when our makes the enemy. There'll be smoke on the mountains where the heathen gods stay, and the sun that is rising will go down on that day. Hirohito along with Hitler will be riding on a rail. Mussolini'll beg for mercy, as a leader he has failed. But there'll be no time for pity when the screaming eagle flies. That will be the end of Axis, they must answer with their lives. There'll be smoke on the water, on the land and the sea, when our army and navy overtakes the enemy. There'll be smoke on the mountains where the heathen gods stay, and the sun that is rising will go down on that day. Smoke on the mountains where the heathen gods stay, and the sun that is rising will go down on that day.